Gregory of Nyssa was born in Caesarea, in present-day Turkey, around 335 AD. Younger brother of St. Basil the Great, he was the third of the three great Cappadocians, as they're known. The other was Basil's friend Gregory Nazianzen. In this trinity, comments one scholar, are concentrated all the rays of that brilliant epoch of Christianity. The three men not only shared common intellectual and spiritual interests, they were also very good friends. They were to have considerable influence on the development of the church, particularly in its attitude to secular culture.
Theirs was a family with a reputation for piety and fidelity to the church. Their widowed mother and their sister Macrina lived a secluded ascetic life. And it was Macrina, as Gregory wrote in his life of his saintly sister, who was responsible for Basil's conversion from the brilliance of a university career to the ascetical life. As Gregory writes, with a typical younger brother's touch.
The great Basil returned after his long education a practiced rhetorician. He was puffed up beyond measure with the pride of oratory and looked down on the local dignitaries, excelling in his own estimation all men of learning and position. But Macrina took him in hand, and with such speed did she draw him also towards the goals of philosophy that he forsook the glories of this world, and despised fame gained by speaking, and deserted it for this busy life where one toils with one's hands.
With this background, it's hardly surprising that Gregory should have begun life as a lector. But he did not yet feel the pull of a religious vocation. He was drawn to poetry, to literature. He became a teacher of rhetoric. Then he fell in love with a young woman named Theosebia and married her.
We're not told whether they had any children or when Theosebia died, but Gregory was presumably a widower when his life changed direction again. He was persuaded by Gregory Nazianzen, and probably by Basil himself, to retire to Basil's monastery on the river Iris. Not long afterwards, he became a priest. Then, in the autumn of 371, and much against his will, he was consecrated bishop by Basil.
The country at that time was racked by heresy, and in particular by the controversy on Arianism. Basil wanted to build a solid Nicene party in the episcopate of Asia Minor. His aim was to fill the Cappadocian sees with reliable men. So whenever a neighbouring see fell vacant, he tried to arrange the election of an Orthodox candidate.
Then in 372, the government divided Cappadocia into two provinces, leaving Basil as metropolitan of a small area. In an attempt to reassert jurisdiction over the lost territory, he consecrated his friend Gregory Nazianzen, Bishop of Sazima, a desert crossroads village in the lost area, and his brother Gregory, Bishop of Nyssa, another obscure town on the edge of Lower Armenia.
Gregory's gifts were not in the field of practical administration, and he was soon in trouble. The Arians, who opposed him vigorously, accused him falsely of wasting church property, and at a synod in Nyssa, held in his absence in 376, they deposed him. For a time, Gregory led a wandering life. Then, after the death of the Emperor Valens in 378, he returned in triumph to his see.
At the Synod of Antioch in 379, Gregory was entrusted with the visitation of the Diocese of Pontus and elected Metropolitan of Sevaste. Basil had since died, and now his brother began to emerge as a mainstay of Orthodoxy. At the Second Ecumenical Council in Constantinople in 381, he was one of the leading theologians and was acclaimed as Pillar of Truth.
The world of Gregory of Nyssa and his companions is brought to life in this extract from one of his homilies. As a modern historian writes, it was a world where all accepted the subordination of secular activities to the purely religious life. For the man in the street, the real forces that ruled the world were not finance and war and politics, but the powers of the spiritual world. Let's listen to Gregory of Nyssa telling us what would happen if you went into a shop in Byzantium.
The money changer will talk about the begotten and the unbegotten, instead of giving you your money. The baker, instead of telling you the price, will argue that the father is greater than the son. And if you want a bath, the bathkeeper assures you that the son surely proceeds from nothing.
Gregory was an extremely versatile writer. Especially brilliant at exegesis, he also wrote a dogmatic work known as The Great Catechism, treating of the chief dogmas of Christianity, the Trinity of the Godhead, the redemption of mankind through the Incarnation, and the personal acceptance of redeeming grace through baptism and the Eucharist. In the prologue to the 1992 Universal Catechism, we read,
"Periods of renewal in the Church are also intense moments of catechesis, and in the great era of the Fathers of the Church, saintly bishops devoted an important part of their ministry to catechism. For Pope Paul VI, the great catechism of modern times was the Second Vatican Council."
Gregory of Nyssa's catechism aimed at instructing teachers how best to seize the opponent's argument and proceed from his admission, a method employed some 15 centuries later by none other than John Henry Newman.
A certain strength and life and wisdom is observed in what is human. Yet no one would suppose, because of the similarity of terms, that with God, life or strength or wisdom are to be understood as being the same. Rather, the meaning of all such terms is lowered in accord with the standard of our nature. Our nature is weak and subject to corruption because our life is short, our strength is not lasting, and our word is unstable. In the supreme nature, however, everything that is said about it is at the same time elevated to the greatness of that which is contemplated.
Gregory of Nyssa was also the first Christian mystic to attempt a system, writing that there is a direct mystical way for the soul which can rise above the world of sense, an intuitive knowledge, rare, extraordinary.
Gregory's earliest writing is his treatise on virginity, written before he was consecrated bishop. But a modern scholar exclaims that it might well have been an author's crowning achievement of ascetical writing.
"Death begins at birth. But those who have, through virginity, remained aloof from this process, have drawn within themselves the boundary line of death, and have, by their own deeds, checked his advance. They have, as it were, made of themselves a kind of frontier between death and life, and a barrier, too, which thwarts him. If, therefore, death is unable to pass beyond virginity, but in virginity is checked and thwarted, it is plainly demonstrated that virginity is stronger than death. It was not possible that death should cease his works, so long as mankind, by marriage, was working too. He walked the path of life in all generations past. He started with every newborn child and accompanied it to the end. But he found at last in virginity a barrier beyond which he could not pass. Just as in the time of Mary, the Mother of God, the death who had reigned from Adam until then found, when he came to her and dashed his forces against the fruit of her virginity as against a rock, that he was himself shattered against her, so too in every soul that passes through this life in flesh, that is protected by virginity, the strength of death is shattered and annulled, when death finds no place in which to fix his sting."
When Gregory was on his way home from the synod at Antioch, he went to visit his sister Macrina, who was now a superior of a monastery in Pontus. But Macrina, as it turned out, was near to death. As the evening came, she tried to repeat the prayer which, as custom had it, was sung at the lighting of the lamps. Her voice trembled, and, as her brother later recorded, when her hand brought to her face to make the sign had signified the end of the prayer, she drew a great, deep breath and closed her life and prayer together.
Apart from the devotional biography of his sister, Gregory also composed a dialogue dedicated to her memory, in which Macrina declares her views on the soul, death, immortality, resurrection, and the restoration of all things. How much of the dialogue is really Macrina's, no one has ever had the indelicacy to ask.
Hope is operative only so long as the enjoyment of the things hoped for is not in possession. And faith, likewise, is a support against the uncertainty of the things hoped for. This is what Paul says when he defines it. Faith is the substance of things hoped for. When the thing hoped for actually comes, all the other faculties are idle, and love alone remains active, finding nothing to succeed itself.
The importance of Gregory of Nyssa is admitted to be his power of philosophical defence and demonstration of the Catholic faith. He never tired of defending the divine nature, and it was the Star of Nyssa who closed the Trinitarian controversy.
Gregory's eloquence was much appreciated at the imperial court, so that he was called to Constantinople to preach the funeral panegyrics for both the wife and daughter of Theodosius. The last we hear of Gregory is at the Synod of Constantinople in 394.
Apart from his more weighty works, Gregory also wrote a number of letters, of which 29 have come down to us. Two of his letters led to great controversies in the 16th and 17th centuries, one dealing with the unhappy ecclesiastical conditions in Palestine, the other in which he writes of abuses during pilgrimages to Jerusalem.
Gregory of Nyssa died around the year 396. His feast is celebrated on the 8th of March. Recent critics attribute to Gregory of Nyssa two homilies on the Annunciation. Here is an extract from one of them.
The angel comes to Mary and entering says, "Hail, O full of grace." In an instant he exalts the maiden and treats her as a woman, for she has become the mother of the Lord. Hail, O full of grace. Your ancestress, Eve, transgressing, was condemned to bear her sons in pain. You, on the contrary, he fills with joy. She gave birth to Cain, and with him envy and death. You, on the contrary, beget a son who is for all the source of life incorruptible. Hail, therefore, and rejoice. Hail, the serpent's head is crushed. Hail, O full of grace. For calamity is at an end, corruption is dissolved, all sadness now has ceased, joy has flourished, the glad tidings of the prophets have come to pass. The Holy Spirit foretold, speaking through Isaiah's mouth, "Behold, a virgin shall conceive and bear a son. You are this virgin."